You are listening to the Next Best Picture podcast, and this is our review of Love Lies Bleeding.
You talked to your dad recently?
Why?
Give us a call.
Where did you appear from?
Oklahoma.
I've never been anywhere but here.
What were you doing with that big girl?
Get a lot of crazy ass foreigners mostly. How's it going, guys?
This here's Jackie.
Hi.
She needs a job. Says she'll do anything.
Yeah, you like guns?
Not really.
What the fuck you doing here, then? I'm a bit more powerful than a punch, huh?
Fuck yeah.
Call me when it's done.
What is this place?
Huh? You don't understand. Get back in the car.
All right, everybody, you were just listening to the trailer for Love Lies Bleeding, and the story is as follows. Reclusive gym manager Lou falls hard for Jackie, an ambitious bodybuilder headed through town to Las Vegas in pursuit of her dream. But their love ignites violence, pulling them deep into the web of Lou's criminal family. The film is starring Kristen Stewart, Katie O'Brien, Ed Harris, Dave Franco, Jenna Malone, and Anna Baryshnikov. It is written and directed by Rose Glass and co-written by Veronica Tofilska. Here to join me today for this podcast review, I have Josh Parham.
Hello, hello.
And Giovanni Lago.
Rat tails are back, baby.
Rat tails, mullets. I mean, they might as well just call this movie Mullet the Movie. Seriously. Maybe it might be an all-timer in the subgenre for mullets in a film. This is Rose Glass's follow-up to her directorial debut, St. Maud, which came out, unfortunately, here in the U.S. right around the time when the world was shutting down during the pandemic. So it really took a bit for that film to find some life. Of course, it did pretty well overseas and then over here in the U.S. I think it has steadily developed a cult following, and it still contains to this day one of the most shocking, memorable endings to a film that I can recall in quite some time. I remember emerging from that film and thinking to myself, wow, this is a real new talent, someone who has truly announced themselves with a provocative piece of work here. So there was a tremendous amount of anticipation for her follow-up film here, Love Lies Bleeding, which had its world premiere at the 2024 Sundance Film Festival. It's being released here by A24. It has just recently expanded into more theaters, and now let's hear what we all thought about it as a comparison maybe to St. Maud, or as a evolution for Rose Glass as a storyteller. Let's start off first here with Giovanni Lago. Gio, what did you think of Love Lies Bleeding?
Well, this was also a unique experience for me because this was my first time going to an Alamo Drafthouse to watch a movie. So the vibes were already immaculate going in. And I did really like Rose Glass' first film, St. Maud. I don't think it worked entirely for me. I wasn't in the adoration camp, but I've seen how time over people slowly fall in love with it, especially how you mentioned, you know, that do the world practically ending for a bit, that it didn't really get the following it probably would have when it released. So I was already excited for Love Lies Bleeding. I think, you know, that trailer that came out was just so immaculately crafted, and it just felt incredibly like my type of film. Going into it, I was already excited. I think this was in my top number three, actually, most anticipated film of the year. And I'm glad to say I think it lived up to every level I expected it for. I think it's just this incredibly niche slice of Americana, you know, of just the Southern, close to Midwest bodybuilding scene and just roid rage, and it's gory and also incredibly sensual and beautiful and tender. And it's got so much going on, which at times I do think can be a bit distracting, especially towards the ending. I think the performances are out of this world. I think Kristen Stewart, I wrote my Letterboxd reaction. I was like, I think she is up there with Emma Stone about some of the best contemporary working actresses right now. I think she's unreal in this movie. I think this is such a project that's incredibly suited to her skill sets as a performer. But, like, you know, we talk about Kristen Stewart, and I'm sure we're going to rave about her a bunch, but Katie O'Brien's unreal. I've seen her in other stuff before, mainly TV, like Mandalorian and stuff like that. And she's, you know, she's solid, but this seemed like something she was incredibly passionate about. She does bodybuilding in real life. So she really goes into this performance. It's such a grandiose and angry and performance full of vitriol. I loved it. I think them together are great. I think Ed Harris getting time to cook is also great. We don't really see like Ed Harris do much besides, like, I'm trying to remember the last film, besides like one scene in Top Gun Maverick and like The Lost Daughter. So him just being the most ratty, long hair, gun-toting criminal. Yes, I dig the whole aesthetic. It's truly a vibe film, especially when it gets towards the end. Some of it might take people out, but I was already locked in. I just felt like this might be the coolest movie to come out this year.
All right, all right. Josh Parr, what about you? What did you think?
So I also really did enjoy Rose Glass's previous movie, Saint Maud. Not a perfect film, but one that showed a lot of potential, especially with the filmmaking and the atmosphere that she was able to create with that. And I felt very similarly about Love Lies Bleeding. I think that I was really interested, like, right off the bat with this world that was being created that, you know, you kind of take a moment to figure out, like, even exactly where it's set, because it doesn't really telegraph that to you, but it's so, it feels so rich and textured. And I love the characters that it was presenting us that felt like that they were these outsiders, but you were slowly getting drawn into their dynamic. And I really was enjoying that in this whole, like, criminal underbelly that they were, that was sort of existing on the peripheries, but was encroaching in. I think the movie does start to lose me a bit as it goes on. I think that its attempts to go bigger with some more stylish things in its narrative, sometimes they work and I'm like, oh, this is like kind of batshit crazy, but I'm sort of into it. But I do think it kind of reaches a critical moment when it's a little too much for me. And I don't know if it really lands like all of its metaphors and all of the strands that it's trying to follow. And I do have to admit that, especially towards the third act, I was waiting for it to really land with something that would be more impactful that just ended up losing me a bit. And that was kind of unfortunate. But having said that, I still found myself pretty interested in the story. And I still think the movie is a really engaging exercise. It's just unfortunate that what I think started out really strong just lost a lot of steam by the end. But I still liked the movie overall.
So I will start off by saying this is very much my kind of movie. It's a dark neo-noir that blends romance with violence. It has this love story tied to it that you get really wrapped up in. And it's also about ordinary people caught up in imaginary, but also like unbelievable circumstances. I say imaginary because, as you said, Josh, there are some psychedelic aspects to this movie, a slight supernatural, we'll say, element to it that produces yet another extremely memorable ending, I'll say, for Rose Glass. Maybe this will be a reoccurring theme in her filmography moving forward. But I was so sucked into the alluring atmosphere. Film is set in 1989 in New Mexico. So right away, I'm thinking, okay, we got Breaking Bad kind of vibes here based on the setting. Clint Mansell is delivering this really, really great atmospheric score that is just seeping through every element of this movie to the point that it's just like, as Gio said, you're kind of just locked in. Now, I can see how once the story starts to get a little bit more batshit crazy, and, you know, some people might say it goes off the rails a little bit. I completely understand that mentality. In fact, Josh, like, hearing your comments, not surprised at all. Like, not shocked to hear you say what you said here. I totally get it, because I knew, I don't want to give it away, but I knew when I saw where this film was going, I thought to myself, oh man, people are going to be really into probably the setup of this film, but when it starts getting hyper-violent and the tension and the stakes just start rising, and then how it all resolves at the end, I think it's going to lose some people. So for me, it very much did not. I enjoyed the hell out of this movie. Now, with that said, do I think it's like an important film? Do I think it's going to like go down as one of the absolute best movies I see this year? Probably not. But as a film just for sheer enjoyment, for me personally, like, this was a hell of a good time. And I really, really liked, especially just its overall premise. I was thinking a lot about how, you know, and I'll ask you guys, I guess this on a personal level, you ever like fallen hard for someone so much so that then when you actually like get to know them, you do either discover some crazy whacked up shit about their family or something about their past that makes you want to run away, but you end up staying with them anyway?
I don't know what you're talking about. That is completely foreign.
Yeah. Love conquers all, Josh, okay? All the red flags thrown out the window. And in this movie, it's literally just red goop, just blood everywhere instead of flags.
You've watched them in unforgettable adventures, love affairs, and tragedies. Now it's time to hear their own remarkable stories. From the makers of Death of a Rockstar and Death of a Sports Star, this is Death
Ready.
Of a Film Star.
And action.
Starring Heath Ledger, Marilyn Monroe, Chadwick Boseman, Robin Williams, Carrie Fisher, and Bruce Lee. Search for Death of a Film Star in your podcast app. You've seen them tell stories. Now it's time to tell theirs.
But that was what I kept thinking about, was like, what do we do for love? Like, when we are head over heels in love with somebody and then we start to get to know them as a person. And it's like these two characters, Lou and Jackie, like, poor Jackie gets mixed up with Lou and her ties to her criminal family. And yet, even though she's not necessarily like, I wouldn't say in on it, she is still a part of it. And it is something that that conflict, that drama for me was the relatable element that I was really like latching on to throughout, because I have had relationships where it's like you start to get to know someone and you uncover stuff and you're like, whoa, oh, there's a backstory there. You know, it's like, do I want to stay or do I want to go?
And that's the strongest element of this narrative for me, is that relationship, that dynamic between those two characters that I was so into in the initial setup to that, because I do think that they're both really fascinating just on their own in terms of their own backstories and the baggage that they have, and how once it becomes this relationship where it intermingles with with each other, then it's like, oh, now we're seeing the true test of this. And I was intrigued by that. But yeah, as you mentioned, Matt, I do think as the movie goes on, it does start to go into more bigger, more fantastical territory, which a part of me I was sort of into, because I do like it sometimes when a movie just says, you know, we're going to be weird and just go with us on the ride. But I think there was just also something about it where it felt like the intimacy of peering into those characters kind of started to go by the wayside, and that it was just more indulging in those fantastical elements at the expense of really honing in on these characters that I was really fascinated by. And I just felt a bit of a distance once the movie kept going.
Yeah, I could have used a little bit more intimacy, I would say, in the relationship. It's sexually charged. There's, of course, that physical attraction between them. And during those scenes in the movie, it's definitely very steamy. It evokes the feeling of watching like an 80s like erotic thriller of some sort. And I, like I said before, was very, very into how much Rose Glass was both leaning into, I would argue, some form of some inspirations of other cinematic films, you know, from that era. But also, too, like, there just was, I think, because of those big swings that she took with some of the more psychedelic and supernatural elements, especially regarding the ending. I think that's what helped this to stand out. Without that, it's just another steamy kind of neo-noir, like, sexy thriller, you know? It doesn't, I don't know how it differentiates itself without those elements.
I do think, though, that like the physical aspect of their relationship is, of course, so integral to it, because I do agree there's like very cute, intimate moments between them that really deepen the relationship. I think especially the final shot of that movie, like the ending, really cements that. But I this is a movie about like bodybuilding, and sex is such an integral also part of their relationship, and it's so carnal and so physical, and the human body is just so focused on this movie. So I do see how some moments are like, we could use a little bit more like quieter intimacy, but like I think the abrasiveness of just constant skin, whether it's them hooking up, whether aggressively or not, or you know, scenes where Jackie is like working out, and as she's furthering and furthering and spiraling out, like her muscles are starting to stretch. Shout out to the sound work. I think the sound work in the movie is so immaculate and will go down some of the best of the year, because just the way you hear, like when you're working out, you know, when you're, it's doing weightlifting, it's, you're literally tearing the fibers of your muscle. And then when you're starting to eat all that, it's like healing it. You can like hear the muscles tear as she's just working out more and more, and they're stretching and the veins start swelling. And I just think the whole physical component about it being so integral is just honestly outweighs the quieter, intimate moments for me.
Yeah, I agree with that, because on one hand, the physical attractiveness of the two of them, like the energy that they are drawn to in one another, is what gives the film its propulsive energy, mm-hmm. and creates that sensational feeling in life and as a viewer that we can relate to, where that rush of love and that rush of attraction will push you to do crazy things. You know, the old saying of love makes you do crazy things, right? I think that that is something that the film is going for, but in doing so, it then has to sacrifice, I think, a little bit more character work that could have gone into some more of the intimate moments between them. I'm not saying that it's completely absent here, because I do think that there are, especially in the first 45 minutes or so, those moments sprinkled throughout. But I really wish that this movie could have like just spent just a little bit more time of us getting to understand Jackie as a character. I think we have a better understanding of Lou as a character in this, but I think Jackie is treated secondary to her, and that's something that I think could have been gained from that. On the other hand, though, like I said, it's been a give and take, because by giving the film kind of that rush of adrenaline and excitement of falling in love with someone and the things that that will push someone to do for them, that is what keeps the momentum of the film up. And that is something that I really appreciate.
I love how you're mentioning that, like a shot of like, well, that's what love is. And I think, you know, Jackie's clearly, the whole movie is her like furthering down, roiding up. But for the equivalent of Lou's roids, it's like being more and more attached to this relationship. And like you said, what she would do for the love of it and to keep Jackie in her life. And I think also, you know, with Jackie, I do find her backstory interesting. It clearly is, like you mentioned, second fiddle to Lou. But I think it works, because I think the whole thing is Jackie is like this oncomer and just gets so enveloped in Lou's world and how that slowly taints her, whether it's everything that boils down with JJ or Lou introducing her to start taking roids and how that starts pushing her further and further off the deep end. I think it works for her because it's very much how she is tainted by this love. And, you know, it's a very pure, innocent love to a degree, but there is a bit of toxicity. You know, in the beginning of the movie, Lou was cleaning up a mess. And then at the end of the movie, she's also cleaning up a mess, but this time from like Jackie. And it's certain moments where it's like, this is very one-sided. And you're seeing how these power dynamics are constantly shifting between the both of them as the film goes throughout.
You know, at the same time, though, I just feel like, you know, there's a very dramatic act that Jackie takes in the name of love that happens in this movie.
Yeah.
And, yes. You know, I would sort of like to feel, not that it is unjustified or not believable within this story, but it, to me, it did kind of feel like that is a very dramatic action to take from a character that up until this point, like, I get the intensity of their relationship, I get the connection that they're having, but I don't know if it has gone quite that deep for me. And I think at that point, it's really at that point is when the movie just loses that real intimacy and feels like it is more indulgent of this almost like horror type, you know, thriller atmosphere. And I was engaged by it, but not as much as I was with the character stuff beforehand. And I think that's where I felt a little bit of a disappointment with where the story was going at that particular juncture. That it was still interesting, I was still into it, but I felt like it traded off the character study for more atmosphere, and I just wasn't as into it with the previous part.
I totally get that, especially how you can see it as being more so a catalyst, so that way the plot can go forward. But I do think, like, with Jackie, you know, we see her, but it's not like she's not prone to acting out to a degree, because there's that whole interaction where they're smoking together, and then the gym dude comes up and she punches him. I just chalked it up to her just starting to juice. And the more she started juicing, you know, just the anger and all the emotions come out. But, like, I totally see how that could be just a big leap.
I don't think that's meant to be taken so literally, though. I really do think, yes, that's a part of it, and you can read that on the surface, but I do think it is supposed to just be a metaphor for, like, not overdosing, but, like, you know, just essentially allowing herself to be consumed by this passion that she has for this other person and what it will push her to do. I do think that the steroids are meant to be sort of like a, you know, very, very flimsy kind of metaphor for this.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, like, the steroids are meant to be used in the world of bodybuilding to achieve the goal of competing in, like, you know, like the competition that she wants to win, you know, for example. Whereas, you know, with her relationship with Lou, it's not the steroids, but, like, it's this, like, passion. It's this this desire and lust that she has that is driving her to win another prize, if you will, in this case. And like I said, I think it's a little flimsy between the two, but I think that that is the intention behind the metaphor of it all. I don't really think this movie is actually taking, like, a definitive stance here on steroid use or gun use within this country or anything like that. I could see how that could be read into, but I really don't think that the movie has any of this necessarily on its mind from a political or social standpoint.
Yeah. I think also just the way, I mean, to your point also, like, the steroid use is, like, used as foreplay. Like, when they're, like, beating up and she introduces it, and it's literally foreplay just with needles. And I guess it's, like, a direct metaphor for, like, injecting her with, like, this affection and love, and then they begin to hook up, and that's how the relationship starts.
Sure. Sure. And everything, too, I was also thinking a lot about in watching this, and Josh, just going back to some of the comments you were making earlier, I couldn't help but think to myself, you know, the world that this is set in, the characters and the way they're set up, it reminds me so much of something like I mentioned this earlier, like Breaking Bad or like Ozark, right? Where these are just ordinary people caught up in a criminal underworld. And yes, we mentioned there's some supernatural aspects to this here, but those shows are very much grounded within reality. And I think in the case of, like, being able to tell this over the course of, say, like a mini series or something, it would have allowed for some of those more specific character moments to kind of, like, come through a little bit more. Whereas this, you know, you have a runtime of just over 100 minutes. Things have to move quickly, and some of that nuance gets lost in the process. I think that's just, you know, the advantage and disadvantage of working within the medium of film versus, you know, through television, where you have that longer format to be able to dive a little bit deeper into the characters, the setting, explore the themes a little bit more. And I that was what I was thinking of the most while watching this, in terms of, okay, why is this not fully working for me? And I think it's just the limitation of runtime.
I think that's a part of it. I think for me, it is also just that the decisions that the story makes at a certain point just feels like it is shifting its focus away from a more compelling dynamic between these two people at this. And I think that it becomes more obsessed with the atmosphere that it's creating and the violence that it's showcasing. And that just was not quite as interesting to me. And I think especially if you're going to do that, oh, I wanted a lot more of Ed Harris then. Like, I wanted more of his just scuzzy, you know, like, low-level criminal. Like, I wanted if we were going to be indulging more in that particular world, then I wanted more of it. Like, I wanted to see this really bad guy who just can give you a look and you're scared. And we don't really get that much of Ed Harris in that section of the film. And I think he's really good at what he's been given to do. But if you're going to go for that indulgence, then I really want that indulgence. And I didn't feel like it went all that way for me.
I kind of agree with you. I do. But I will say this, though. Dave Franco gives a jaw-dropping performance in this movie.
I did like him a lot, yeah.
He was really good. It's the first shot of him in the car when him and Jackie are hooking up. I was like, okay.
Hold on, man. Hold on. Did my pun go over both of your heads?
Wait, what? What did you say?
I said jaw-dropping performance.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Yes. Okay. Wow.
His performance is not that amazing. It's nothing out. It's nothing special.
I mean, he was willing to go for it, though.
Yeah.
The way, though, that his character,
exits the story.
Sorry.
Hey, you know what? We were that impressed with him that we didn't even notice. We took it as a real compliment.
I think he's really good in it for, like, what little screen time he has. You know, he's just a scumbag, but he's really, like, this little number two henchman to Ed Harris. And it feels like all the insecurities he has, he just takes it out on his poor wife, who's Lou's sister, which is also a big, like, grounding force for the movie and, like, that relationship. Until the ending, which I have a little bit of a complaint about, but I think, you know, his use in the story is good. And that whole sequence is great. I think it kind of tends into when the whole altercation comes between Jackie and JJ. And seeing that, it felt very much grounded in that world. But then some of the other moments where you mentioned does get fantastical. I think mainly there's a bodybuilding sequence where it involves like a larva. And I know it's supposed to represent like the larva also that like Ed Harris has. But I'm like, all right. And then it goes further and further. And I feel like if you're not dialed into that wavelength, you are just not really going to like it.
In all honesty, though, outside of O'Brien and Stewart, the performance that actually captivated me the most was Anna Baryshnikov,
yes.
who plays Daisy in this.
So good.
I thought all of her scenes with Lou especially were really, really phenomenal. And, oh, that's another one where what happens to that character? My God.
I was shocked. I was shocked. I was like, what's happening?
Audience jumped like crazy.
I think with her character, though, it's, you know, on the surface, it's like, oh, it's the ditzy blonde. And she's like obsessing over Lou the whole movie. But like as the plot develops, she's actually far more calculated than she appears to be. And it gives her like this underhand that you're like a wild card. You don't know what she's going to do or what you expect from her. And that led like to a very interesting dynamic between her, Lou, and Jackie.
Yeah, she's the character that everybody assumes is just dumb, but in doing so, they underestimate how like dangerous she could be. And
right,
you know, not a particularly novel trope to see in a movie, but I do think it's executed very well here. And I think the performance really, really steers into it. There's especially a moment when she has a telephone call with Jackie that was like really like very chilling for that moment. It was very, very well done.
Yeah, when the mask comes off, literally everything comes off literally.
Yeah, everything.
I gotta say though too, I have really, really enjoyed Kristen Stewart's work throughout her entire career post Twilight, because once again, those films, not her fault. She did the best that she could with what she was given. But ever since then, she has just continually knocked it out of the park with so many great performances. Dare I say, I actually think that this is one of her best performances I've seen her give in recent memory.
Yep.
And there are two moments in particular that really solidified this for me. It's the line reading of a simple three-lettered word, yup, on the phone to Ed Harris, and then another simple three-lettered word where she says, huh?
Did that involve the door that we just mentioned?
Mm-hmm.
Was a great thing. That I, again, like you mentioned, the audience jumped and everything. When that happened, I was just like in a state of like disillusioned shock where I was like, what's happening? Like, this isn't real. Like, did she just step on something? Like, what's going on? And then like when the camera cuts, then you see what's happened, you're like, what the fuck?
Yeah, I just think that she does such an amazing job of taking very, very small moments and making them feel so natural and authentic to the point that I'm just like so dialed in into the performance and the story. She's such a good emotional anchor for this that I think that's what really helped me to get involved with everything that was happening, even though, as you know, we've mentioned, some of it goes beyond the practical and you know, what actually is possible and starts veering into some really crazy directions. She was the human element of it all that like kind of just kept me always centered.
Oh, she's so great. And I really just love her basically in everything, to be honest. I think she can make even bad material sing. And you're right, there's such a grounded nature to her where she really does feel like she is a part of this world, that, you know, there's no glamour to it. She, there are very dramatic things that happen, but she handles them like a normal person would, and you really do buy into the intensity of the relationship that she's pursuing and the intensity of the these darker elements that are around her and how she's trying to push that out and navigate through it. And I think Stewart just has a really incredible ability to inhabit all those different kinds of dramatic emotions within those characters, and this is another really good example. I don't know if I would say it's like one of my top tier favorites from her, but I think that she is really, really good at the same time.
It also works as a good balance because with Katie O'Brien, you know, especially with her storyline and how it goes, it becomes more, I wouldn't say over the top, but more larger than life. Literally larger than life. So having that fair share of just the grounded nature of Stewart's performance and then Katie O'Brien, especially when it comes to like the more weightlifting scenes and especially toward the end with the shows and how the everything plays out, it works so well. It never feels like it's uneven between the two of them.
I think the thing too about Katie O'Brien in this too is that I am vaguely familiar with her work in Mandalorian MCU, but to me, this is like a true breakout role for her. I understand those projects might have felt like that, maybe to her at the time when she got them, especially considering the IP attached to them. But this here is, I think, just a great example of merging part to performer, where it really feels like she was essentially like born to play a role like this based on her backstory. And I really feel that authenticity coming through on the screen in her performance, that I think she's just such a magnetic, captivating presence here. And it's something that I really, really hope opens up even more doors for her than those other projects did, where I feel like she's very much overshadowed by so many other elements contained within them. And here she gets to be more front and center.
Also, what's great about the both of them, besides them just being an incredibly attractive couple that are amazing actors in the film, like they kick ass, the outfits they wear are so good. And like, I know it's quote unquote, I mean, I guess it is period costume because it's in the 80s. Jesus.
89. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but like every fit they wear together, it's just, it feels so like, yeah, that's exactly what those characters wear, whether it's Jackie's outfits or even like a Lou's like shirt she wears for the gym. Just with those jeans, like that shirt's so cool. I can tell you right now, A24 is already probably lined up, ready to start selling them because I would buy it. It looks great. Although Ed Harris's fits a bit out there, especially with when he had the ponytail at one point, because I was like, man, where did his hair go? And then I see the ponytail. I was like, okay.
Oh, man. We need to bring back the skullet, you know, into modern day fashion.
Do you want to do it, Matt? Well. Matt, lead the way. Lead the way.
I'm not pointing the way on that one. Somebody else can do it. but I agree with you, just in terms of the style of this movie, from its period setting to the soundtrack. Love the soundtrack to this movie.
So good.
I think Clint Mansell is one of those like underrated composers too, who adds so much atmosphere to all the projects that he's tied to. And of course, I think about his work with Aronofsky, and I think here, like, this was just such a well-tailored project to his strengths as a composer.
Oh, yeah. When I saw Clint Mansell's name pop up, I got so excited because I love him. I love the music that he creates, and it is so perfectly suited to this movie. You know, it gets the particular time and place really right, and just is a great mood setter. And yeah, oh, I loved his score, as I love most of his scores.
All right. So why don't we go into, I suppose, final thoughts here. Gio, why don't we start off with you? Anything that we didn't mention, something you want to reiterate?
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Burn the Boats from Evergreen Podcasts. I interview political leaders and influencers, folks like award-winning journalist Soledad O'Brien and conservative columnist Bill Kristol, about the choices they confront when failure is not an option. I won't agree with everyone I talk to, but I respect anyone who believes in something enough to risk everything for it. Because history belongs to those willing to burn the boats. Episodes are out every other week wherever you get your podcasts.
I would like to say that Rose Glass, with visual eye as a filmmaker, is so astounding. And, you know, Ben Fordsman, who does the cinematography, shoots the shit out of this movie. It looks so gorgeous. Like, every frame, I'm just like, yes. It just paints that very, like, you know, New Mexico aesthetic. And whenever it does, I think some of the great moments are Lou's like nightmare sequences, and it's got like this dark stain, like neon red, and especially when it's Ed Harris with the guns.
I got to admit, during those moments, I almost thought to myself, you know how everyone is like always going on and on about the A24 aesthetic, and how A24 is a brand in and of itself. I'm like, oh, well, there it is. That's why this is an A24 film. Now, I want to be very, very fair that I understand that this is a very unfair criticism, but there was always just a part of me that was wondering, was this absolutely necessary for the telling of the story, for it to be shot this way, presented this way? And then all I could think to myself was, this just feels so conveniently tied to other projects that A24 puts out that I know this is not true. I want to be very clear. I know this is not true. But the fact that it got me thinking, oh, was this like a mandate from A24 or something that it needed to have something like this? I don't even know why I'm even verbalizing this, because I know it's not true, but it's what my brain was thinking while I was watching it, because it did feel so kind of... It did feel like it clashed a lot with the grounded reality of what was being presented to us throughout. You know, like, that's the thing, is that there is this clash here. And that Josh was talking about this before, where it feels like this is meant to be a story that is like really, you know, taking place within a reality that we all can understand. But then you throw in these psychedelic elements and then the supernatural elements and then the ending, of course. And then I think that's where that clash is just losing people. And it made me question and wonder, was it entirely necessary? To answer my own question, though, I think I've come around to realizing the answer is yes, because of what I said before, which is this is the stuff that helps the movie stand out.
You know, I actually kind of think it's not necessary. That being said, it's fucking cool. And I think the whole movie just emanates this sense of just a vibe where you just want to just get in this world and just it's cool. It kicks ass. You're just watching weights and roids and blood and gore. And I think Rose Glass is like, look, there is this very sweet, intimate romance that is the central aspect of this film. But also, I made a movie that it just rocks, and I cooked, and I think I enjoyed it. That being said, I found that more aligned with the style of the film, especially in the beginning, compared to, like, I'm trying to avoid spoilers. There's a running sequence towards the end that there's a lot of CG, and I felt sure it plays into the more fantastical moments, but I think there's a sense of body horror that's established. You know, this is, of course, someone who directed Saint Maud, and I think whether it's stuff with the jaw or even like the larva sequence, I felt that played more into quote-unquote body horror and not really fantastical compared to the ending, which is just full-blown, like, felt like a shift of those, like, kind of conflicting ideas. But like, it still works. I don't think it ever took me out to a point where I was like, it ruined the film for me. Like, I was dialed in. I've stated like in the beginning of this, I think this is probably going to be the coolest movie of the year. I think it takes up the mantle from The Killer last year of just the cool movie of the year. And I think that's totally fine. I think it's an immaculately well-made vibe piece. I think seeing Kristen Stewart just really go out, especially alongside Katie O'Brien, who, you know, for a breakthrough performance like this, I think you could do far worse. Like, she's amazing. I mean, like Josh, I wish there was more Ed Harris. I think, you know, that whole side piece of like his whole operation into like his whole criminal enterprise and seeing like how that life on the range, especially with JJ and stuff, everything was a bit fascinating. They kind of do sideline that. But like, besides that, I really enjoyed it. I had a great time. I honestly can see this being like the top 10 favorite movies of mine of the year just because I dug it that much.
All right, Josh, what about you? Final thoughts.
I think the only thing that I would mention at the end is probably my favorite, or maybe not my favorite, I think the funniest line reading for me in the movie is a moment between Kristen Stewart and Jenna Malone when she's trying to get some information from her and she's like kind of torturing the Jenna Malone character a bit. And once the information is given, she just yells at her, "Love you, sis."
Yes. Yeah,
so good.
I had that written down. That was one of my favorite moments in this entire movie.
I did really, so really good. Love that moment because it you know, you don't need much explanation, but it just perfectly captures the absurdity of the moment, but the seriousness and highlighting what the dynamic is between those two. And like, you don't need much. You just need that one line, and it was delivered perfectly. You know, one other thing that I will also mention, that as much as I did love the world that was being created and how this movie looked and felt, I did have the thought that I usually have with a lot of movies that kind of are set in this time period, which is sort of like, why it is set in this time period? You know, not that everything needs to be justified, but oftentimes I feel like, is this set in 1989 for a particular purpose, or is it just because we don't like cell phones?
It looks cool.
Yeah. I mean, you could say cell phones, you could say atmosphere, you could say, I think the reason why is because of America's fascination with bodybuilding during this era.
Yeah, the whole Arnold Schwarzenegger type mindset, and just in terms of that and weightlifting, I think that aspect, Matt, that actually makes sense.
There's also the war on drugs.
Yeah.
And also, too, an excuse to pick somebody's soundtrack choices and have it feel at least period accurate versus nostalgia-based. I mean, it is still nostalgia-based, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah. And I think there are certain things within kind of the background. Like I said, the war on drugs, that whole, you know, you hear George Bush talking, that very infamous thing of him describing the crack cocaine. So that is an element within the kind of overall, as we said, atmosphere that has been created. You know, it's not like a major complaint, but every time I do kind of see these movies, I think they maybe just don't want to deal with modern technology, which I understand. But, you know, I think it's a little bit of an arbitrary kind of coding to the movie, but still one that is effective for what they're trying to create.
I don't disagree, but at the same time, I do think that not having that reliance on modern technology does allow for more organic storytelling to emerge from the characters themselves and their own intuition and creativity than just relying on the internet to give them answers. And I think that just is more dramatically compelling to me.
Oh, I agree. I often think that tends to be the main motivation for these kinds of movies being set in the past. That's just something that I tend to notice whenever I see a movie that is set in like the 80s or 90s. It's like, because like that's a time period where it's, you know, 30 years ago, but aesthetically, it doesn't look that much different from today. It's not like you're really indulging in, like, yes, we mentioned there's fashion choices, but they're not like, you know, flamboyant 70s clothing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So whenever I see these types of movies, there is just a thought in my head of like, I wonder if they just did that because they don't want to deal with the issue of cell phones and how easy that would make some of the problems in the plot go away. As I said, I'm not saying this to be like, oh, it's a cheap move or ruins the movie or anything like that. It's just something that I tend to notice with modern movies that are set just like 30 years ago. It's like, maybe that's the reason why they decided to do that.
Yeah. For my final thoughts here, I think this would make a very interesting double watch with Drive-Away Dolls. I understand they're completely different movies, but that's, I think, what would make it so fun as a double feature.
I was going to say real quick, I think the film this reminded me the most, well, not exactly, but I think would be a good companion, is actually Bones and All.
Oh, sure. I could see that, too. I mean, really any kind of a love road movie, right? Like Thelma and Louise or Wild at Heart.
Yeah, throw some gore in there. Ah, perfect. Perfect day just to watch those.
I mean, it's like, it's a lot of things, right? It's a love story. It's a revenge story. At the end of the day, I think what more importantly it is for me, other than just a piece of entertainment, because I was very entertained by this movie, it is, I think, proof that Rose Glass was not a one-hit wonder with St. Maude, and she is the real fucking deal. And I am so, so pumped to see what she does next. Is it going to be something as dark and compelling as these two films have been? Is it going to have another what the fuck kind of out of nowhere ending as these two movies have had? This one a little bit more so than St. Maude's haunting ending that still to this day has scarred me for life. I mean, I don't know, but I'm here for it. I am here for it. With that said, I really enjoyed this. I mentioned earlier, this is exactly like my kind of movie that I love. I love me a good crime film that's dripping in atmosphere, especially one where the stakes are grounded in some form of reality that is relatable. Even the elements in this where it does veer off the tracks from that a little bit, I was still locked in every step of the way due to, I would attribute it to Rose Glass's vision and her control of the atmosphere, the tension, and giving us those moments of cathartic release. You know, I mean, there's nothing that sums up the ending of this movie better than Ed Harris looking bewilderedly and saying, "What the fuck?" So I'm giving this movie a very strong 8 out of 10. I can see how for some people they might be a little bit hesitant to go into it for various reasons. I can imagine them walking out of it and being a little reluctant to loving it because of the directions that it takes. But I was very much into it every step of the way. Giovanni, what about you?
I am also very strong 8 out of 10. I would give it a 9 if it wasn't for how the ending plays out in terms of how fantastical it was. Not that it completely lost me, but it was so close to being a 9, but I'm a really strong 8.
Josh?
I'm a little bit lower on it. I'm a 7 out of 10. I did enjoy it. I do have to admit, though, that as the movie went on, yeah, it did kind of lose me a little bit with kind of not really focusing in on those characters as much as I wanted to, but I still liked the movie. I was still engaged by it, just not as much as I was towards the end, as much as the beginning.
No Oscar potential for Love Lies Bleeding, but I wouldn't be surprised if I see Katie O'Brien make a couple of breakout performance lists for the end of the year.
I can see her get a Gotham nomination.
Really?
Yeah.
I could see that.
I could say, I feel like that's a type of performance like a Aubrey Plaza and Emily the Criminal type film that gets like a Gotham nomination. Although, when it comes to Oscars, it's not sniffing an Oscar, but I will say in a just world, that sound work should be nominated because it is fantastic. Like, whether it's body parts breaking off or the gunshots or muscle fibers tearing and stretching. I thought it's like incredibly immersive for a relatively small type of film like this to have that great sound work.
Yeah. Yeah. I would like to see smaller movies like this get recognized in that area. Unfortunately,
it won't happen.
Not the world that we live in, but I'm glad that we're pointing it out at least.
Yeah. But Gotham's, I can see this being like a Gotham movie.
Yeah, we'll see. All right, well, that'll do it for our review of Love Lies Bleeding here on the Next Best Picture podcast. Josh Parham, tell everyone that's listening where they can find you on the internet.
You can find me on Twitter and Letterboxd at J.R. Parham.
And Giovanni Lago, tell everyone where they can find you on the internet.
Find me on Twitter at the Giovanni Lago.
You can also find him at the gym from time to time as well, people. You can find me at Next Best Picture. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening to our review of Love Lies Bleeding here on the Next Best Picture podcast. We are proud to be part of the Evergreen Podcast Network, and you can subscribe to us anywhere where you subscribe to podcasts. Be sure to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts to let us know what you think of the show. We really appreciate your feedback and your support, which you can also lend on over at Patreon. For $1 minimum a month, you will get some exclusive podcast content from us. Thank you all so much for listening, as always, and we will see you all next time.
Hello, this is Gary Chachot welcoming you to check out the French History Podcast. Our main show covers the history of France from the first humans until present. If you liked Mike Duncan's The History of Rome and wanted a similar program covering the land of beauty, culture, and love, we are exactly that. We also host world-renowned scholars who have delivered guest episodes on their specialties, including 18th-century pirates, revolutionary booksellers in 20th century Paris, the special friendship between the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson, and numerous others. Learn what you love and listen to the French History Podcast today.